So Omar Rabba Bohu, Omar Rabbi Yochanan. So now Rabba Bohu quotes Rabbi Yochanan, who said, Minayin, the Zoveach Behemo Balas Bum Lavidis Kachovim Shehu Potur. How do we know that if a person sacrifices an animal which has a blemish in it, and he sacrifices it for a Zoveach Zorah, that he is not held guilty, you know, of violating the law, okay? Not, some say that Chayev and Potter in this case means Chayev would be, he would deserve the death penalty for worshipping an idol, and Potter means he would not deserve the death penalty for it, okay? But, okay. I'm telling you how, you know, traditionally it's been understood, but I prefer to look at it a little bit more nicely. Okay. All right. So how do we know that? Okay. First of all, we have to compare it. How about the Beis HaMikdash? Were we permitted to sacrifice an animal which had a blemish? No. Torah prohibits it specifically. Okay. Kol mum no yebo, and so not only that, but what does the Torah have to say about the Kohen who is performing service in the Beis HaMikdash? Same story, right? Right. A Kohen who has a blemish is permitted to share in the sacrifices, but not to perform. That's prohibited. Okay. So. So why should he be potter? Because in the Beis HaMikdash we did not sacrifice an animal which was a balmum or a balasbum. Okay. Shenemar, the pasuk says, Zoveach lo Elohim yacharon bilti la Hashem levado. In other words, what he's quoting over here is something that any person who sacrifices to an idol is to be condemned. And he should only sacrifice to whom? To the God alone. Okay? Lo Asra Torah. The Torah did not prohibit sacrifice of this time, this type, Eloke Ein Pnim, except for something that actually took place in the Beis HaMikdash. So Havi Bar Rabba. So Rabba gave the following explanation. He said, but my, what kind of situation are we talking about over here? He says, Ilema, if we talk about the fact that the Dukin Sheba Ayin, what a Dukin Sheba Ayin? Dukin means that there are like little blemishes within the eye itself. In other words, what we would call today in modern language, you know, a cataract. Okay? Now, apparently, even animals can have cataracts. That's the point. There's a very famous incident told in Gemara in Gittin about, you know, Kamsa, Bar Kamsa. I'm sure that you may have heard those names. Yes. How Kamsa was supposed to be invited to the feast, and instead it was Bar Kamsa and so on. At any rate, what happened? He was so insulted by the host, put to shame, that he became very angry and decided he was going to denounce the Jewish people. So he went to Rome and he spoke to the emperor and he said, the Jews are rebelling against you. And the emperor said to him, what proof do you have? So he says, I'll give you proof. Send the sacrifice with me to the Beis HaMikdash and see whether the Jews will sacrifice it. Okay? So the emperor agreed this would be a good idea. So he went back, and before he reached the Beis HaMikdash, he made a little blemish. And the Gemara there says, what was the blemish on the animal? Either it's Bedukin Shebayin or it's something on the lip itself. But at any rate, these things did not disqualify a sacrifice as far as the Goyim were concerned, as far as the Romans were concerned. But it disqualified a sacrifice as far as the Jews. And then there's the whole Maisa, you know, as to whether to sacrifice it, not to sacrifice it. And finally the argument went out not the sacrifice. Okay? And as a result, the emperor, of course, was incensed, was angry, you know, and so he decided that the Jews Taka were rebelling against him, and so he sent the army, you know, to quash the rebellion. And this is what led up to the destruction of the Second Place of Exodus. No, not the Hadrian came after. This was Nero, actually, that killed him, right? But afterwards, right. And then after that, you know, he had actually a succession of guys who didn't last very long. Galba, Otto, and Tullius, finally, they chose a general who was fighting in Eretz Israel, and that was Vespasian. He was the one, and then he handed over the rest of the fight to his son Titus, and he became the new emperor of Rome. The famous story about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who tried to make peace with the Romans, and it's one of the most fascinating stories that we have in the Gemara. So it's Gemara Git that we have. That's why the Chachamim really were in favor of doing it. But there was one holdout, and he persuaded them that they should not do it. So, yeah. You're right. Right. The others wanted to do it. They figured, yeah, look, what are we accomplishing over here? But, his argument went out, and as a result, tragedy occurred. Okay. So as I said, Dukan Shabayan, in other words, that was a blemish that does not disqualify as far as idolatry is concerned, but does disqualify as far as the Beis HaMikdash is concerned. Okay, so what Robert is saying over here, it says, you know, that, you know, maybe this was the boom, right? The Dukan Shabayan. So, the question is now, Hashtub Deinea Chazya Ligavea. Now that it's okay to the Bnei Noach, in other words, you know, to Noah and his descendants, who are not yet Jews, as you understand, right? To sacrifice it to God, the Boma did who, right? On their own Boma is literally, it's like an altar, but it was not the official Mizbeach, you understand, okay? Means literally upon a height or something like that, but you know, this was at a time, you know, when people were permitted to make their own private sacrifices wherever they wanted. So that was a boma, okay? If the Rabbeinu Shel Olam gave permission to the Bnei Noach to sacrifice to God something which had a Dukan Shabayin, right? In other words, it had a blemish. So certainly it would be permissible to sacrifice it to an idol. Do I have to ask him? Of course, that's what he says. Elo b'mechusa eva. So the mum would have to be a more serious type. Namely, that the it was lacking one of its limbs. One of its limbs had been cut off, whatever it may be. Okay? Uchter Rabbi Elazar, and this would be in accordance with Rabbi Elazar, Doma Rabbi Elazar, as Rabbi Elazar said, Madayan Mechusa Ever Shehu Osim Deidoyach. How do we know that an animal which is lacking one of its limbs is also prohibited to the Bnei Noach? Shenemar, as it's written, Umikol Hachai, Mikol Boso, Shnaim Mikol, right? From everything that is living, from every flesh, two of everyone, right? Omra Torah. The Torah said. And what is the meaning? Pardon me. It means Hove Behemo, bring an animal, Shechayim Roshe Evor Shalom, whose limbs are literally alive, in other words, in possession of every one of its limbs.
pardon me. So they say, no. Since we're talking about B'nai Noach, let's take a look at those psukim, all right? It says, Mikol HaChai. Why does it say that from everything which is living? Why doesn't it apply to what? You know, to the Rosh Hashanah. So it says, that's to the Ute Trefo, your lettuce. That's to the Ute Trefo. This is in order to exclude an animal which has, you know, trefo means that not just, you know, that's not kosher. The trefo over here also implies, you know, that it has a vital organ that's no good. Okay? So now he says, maybe that derives from another pasuk over there. Says, right? Why can't we get us from the fact that it's written, you know, that the animal has to be in order to be able to give life to its seed. In other words, be able to propagate, right? So, Ani Cholaman Omar, in accordance with the authority who says, Trefo Eino your lettuce, there is other machlokes in the first chapter, as a matter of fact, of it is, or whether an animal which is Trefo, in other words, if it's missing one of its vital organs, whether it's possible to have progeny. Okay? So obviously then, okay, so say that would exclude that, right? Elo lamando Omar, but there is a contrary opinion that says that, pray for your lettuce, that nevertheless an animal, even if it has a vital organ that's no good, it still is possible to propagate. So mayika lamema, so what are you going to say then? So they have to bring another pasuk, Omar Kuros, so this is why the pasuk says, itok. Itok means literally with you. Okay? So what does it mean, itok? It says, itok means itok bedomen lo. In other words, the animal should be in the same condition as you. So therefore, next question. See how they argue these points back and forth. It says, with Dilma, Noach gufei trefa hava? Maybe Noah himself was unable to propagate. We know he had three sons, right? Shem, Ham, and Yefes. How could they come up with this idea? Right? But there's a story that says afterwards, after they got off from the ark, you know, and Noah planted his vineyard, and the sons, remember, he castigated his grandson, Chob, Chom, and Canaan, remember, right. So, there's a story that he was castrated by them or something, or whatever. So, maybe this is what they had in mind. I mean, there is such a medrash, you see, okay? Yeah, there is such a medrash, okay? So, in that case, the wise authority say, like you, right? And we said that means like you, the domain law. So, how could you say that? It says, it's Tomim Kisirbe, right? Doesn't the Torah say that he was Tomim? Tomim means he was 100% perfect, right? So, in other words, he certainly would be able to propagate. So that therefore, Dilma, maybe it means Tamim Bidrachov, that, you know, the word Tamim applies not to his physical condition, but it means in the way of life that he was leading. Right? So they say, wait a minute, we have another word over there. What's written over there? Tzadik Ksiv. It's written that he was a tzadik. So what do we have to say, Tamim, in the sense that he lived a good life? So they say, Dilma why do we have Tamim and Tzadik? Dilma, he was Tamim B'drachov, as we said a moment ago, that he was, you know, wholehearted in his ways. But Tzadik B'masov, and also he was righteous in all his deeds. So he says, Le'motzis Amrit D'noyak Gufi Trefahavi. Says, you cannot argue that Noah himself was Trefa. Why? The Isalkodatech Noach Trefa Havo, if we say that Noah himself was lacking, you know, an essential limb or sick enough, so Amalei Rachmona, so why would the Rebbeinu Shleilim say unto him, Dechavosoch Ayel, Shalomim, and Shleimim Lot Ayel, would the Rebbeinu Shleilim say to him that you should bring in animals like you? Now, if Noah himself was Trefa, what? Are we saying, Noah, bring in Trefa animals, right? And shleim in lo tail, and don't bring in perfectly whole animals? Doesn't make sense. So they say, hashto the naf go be itoch, inasmuch as we come back again to the word itoch. So, why does it say then, why do I need to say, in order that they should be able to give life to offspring? If it is, may itok. I might have argued that itok means simply taking animals into the yard to keep you company. But hashta the nafka be yitok. Yes, in other words, you could even bring in for company an old animal, an animal that has already been castrated, you know, in other words, one incapable of propagating anymore. So Kamashmullah, and that's why the Torah says to us, no, we have to have good animals in good shape. Why? Because they have to be capable of the Hachayos Zera, to give life to seeds, life to, future generation. Okay. I like the way they argue back and forth over here. They analyze each word to see.
Maybe it's like so.
You're right. But again, what started off this whole discussion? The statement that said, by Rabbi Amin, that look, is a person who sacrifices an animal which is a balas mum, in other words, has a blemish, is he liable or is he potter? Sacrifice it, not talking in the Beis HaMikdash, but talking, you know, to an idol, is he? So he wants to substantiate the fact, you know, that he is potter. Why? Because even people in the generation of Noah and so on, before we had the Torah given to us, right, were still sacrificing animals that had no blemish. The fact that Dukin Shevayin, so he said that's not a blemish, that's so obvious. But the Chusar Aver, an animal that's missing a limb or something like that, the obvious thing, they wouldn't think of doing that either. So if a person wanted to sacrifice to an idol like Baal Asmud, so he's doing the wrong thing, but nevertheless he would not be guilty. Okay, that's what they're trying to say. Okay.
This is a Jew who wants to sacrifice an animal that has a blemish on it to Avodah Zarah. I don't follow this at all.
You know, people do crazy things. There may have been Jews who decided to do something. Understand?
Why would
so that's
any
why
sacrifice
there, right?
With its blemished
a lot of it is theoretical. I have to take it to you. Let's say a Jew sacrifices something. Madoch, if an idolater is sacrificing, and he's careful, you know, to sacrifice an animal without a blemish.
Right.
So if a Jew sacrifices to an idol, an animal with a blemish, then that's a different case. Obviously, he can't be serious about what he's sacrificing. Understand? He can't be serious. If he really wanted to serve the Aveda Zorah, and in that case, he would have sacrificed the real animal. And this is what the next line says over there. So let's go that far. We'll go down towards the bottom of the page, okay? So Rabbi Elazar said, "Minayin l'sheichet behem l'markulah shehu chayav." How do we know that the person sacrifices an animal to Markulis? Well, of course, over here, Markulis is any idol, not just the mercury, right? That he is guilty, Shenemar, because the Pasuk says, "V'lo yizbechu od as if chayhem l'si'irim," that they should no longer sacrifice their sacrifices to, the English translation is the satyrs, but actually what it means is to the reed. I'll come back to that in a second. It means, you know, to idols. So what are the satyrs? The word satyr in Hebrew means a goat, okay? And if you remember, in Greek mythology, they had, you know, sort of like half goat, half man, or something like that. So those were the satyrs, okay? And they were supposed to be full of lust, too, if you remember. Right? So if a Jew does that, that's exactly what it says, you know, that he's chayev, he's guilty, because the Torah says that they are no longer to sacrifice their sacrifices to the satyrs. And Imeinu Inyan Bekedarko, and if we already know that it's prohibited to do it the way a person would normally sacrifice, Dichsiv, as the Pasuk says, Echo Yavdu Agoyim Ve'eles Adayhem, how would the Goyim, these Goyim, sacrifice to their gods? So today, Huvinyon, Shalom Kedarko. So in that case, apply it even to a sacrifice which is not the usual kind. So in other words, this would negate what we had before. Understand? That he was potter. If they did it in the normal way in which sacrifices takes place, right? In other words, an animal which is without a blemish. So in that particular case, obviously he is guilty if he would sacrifice an animal without a blemish. But what about the fact that we said a moment ago that he is potter if he sacrifices an animal which has a blemish in it? So the answer is today a winyan shall lake a dharma. Right. So apply it to sacrifice which is not done in the usual manner, which would imply this. Okay. All right, I'm going to stop at this point, the last line on the page. I've run out of steam, my voice, etc.
And you say, in other words, the argument is that if the Goyim have an irregular sacrifice, they sacrifice...
I'm not talking about the Goyim. The Goyim, we've said before that the Goyim follow the B'nai Doyach, okay? Namely, that they will sacrifice normally an animal which is also a whole.
Right.
Okay? With some of these things, like the cataracts and the eyes, where that would be permitted to them,
right,
and prohibited to us, well, that's already a fine point.
Right.
But the Chusar Aver, even they wouldn't sacrifice, okay?
Right. So, but this last point where somebody, Jew, sacrifices, let's say the animal, Chusar Aver, they're saying, well, that we know this would not be offered by them in a serious manner. So, if a Jew offers it, he's not really doing Avodah Zarah.
Right, right.
But what is this then?
Well, it's so wrong to do it. That's the point.
Okay, why is it
so wrong? It's still wrong because what? You're making a gesture which would seem to indicate that you want to give a tikrovis avedisov. You want to give some kind of a sacrifice to the avedisov.
I understand. I mean, this is my
right.
my personal feeling
right.
about it.
Right.
This is what you were saying. Wait till we get to this.
Right.
thing.
Right.
But that somewhat negates all of the discussion that's gone
no,
above
so.
Because they now you've wiped out the
okay.
nuances. It's not
people want to argue back and forth sure. and back and forth. This is part of Torah learning. What can I tell you?
All right, but the fine nuances are making me in the physical. How can I say the physical, not the health of the animal, the physical condition of the animal?
Yeah.
That's nullified because you're now going to the wrongness of the intention of the person.
Right, right.
The
Jew should not do anything.
So you're looking at the intention,
exactly.
not
the intention.
Exactly.
The intention is wrong. Right. Exactly.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. No, it's just okay.
No, I mean,
maybe it's the over
maybe the whole thing.
The
I mean,
efficiency, which is
they take every word and they analyze it. Why can't we derive it from this? Why can't we derive it
from this?
All right, tonight being the 1st of November in the year 2006, we're in the very last line. A nun aleph of an aleph, and of course we're going immediately into Amud Beis. Right, right. Amud Beis here. Oh, it says nun. Where is nun aleph Amud Beis? Hello. Oh, okay, it's nun aleph Amud Beis. Okay. So now. This last quotation that they had, you know, about Eicha Yavdu HaGoyim Eilis HaLahim, right? And we said that if you cannot apply this verse which says, look, the Goyim wouldn't do something like this, so how can you? And we said that Tanehu, you know, that Tanehu in you should like a darko, that even this applies to, you know, a sacrifice of an animal which is not even what the Goyim themselves would do, right? So they ask, is this the reason why they quote this particular pasuk? No, I'm a boy lay, on the contrary, we need this for a different teaching. Look at the Tanya. As we have learned, what did we learn? It says, Ad Khan Kumadavi Kodoshim Sheikh Doshim Mishas Isa Bobes, we agree with Mishas Isa Bobes. Shari Odshan Amur Shanema Vil Pesah Bavelo Hevio. Okay. So, this brings us now to a little historical perspective about what we read in the Sefer Vayikra Parsha Achrei Mos. Right after the chapter which deals with the laws of Yom Kippur, the ritual of Yom Kippur, so there is this particular chapter which speaks about the Bamos and the Mishkan. So, historically, what came? The Mishkan, right? Mishkan accompanied the people of Israel during the time that they were in the wilderness, and it continued to exist until such a time that they were able to be established in Eretz Israel. Okay? Once they were established in Eretz Israel, there still was no Beis HaMikdash. Because that didn't come until the reign of whom?
Solomon.
Okay, the reign of Solomon, exactly. All right. It was proposed by David, but fulfilled by Solomon. Okay? So there are several hundred years from the time that the Jews conquered Eretz Israel, land of Canaan, you know, until the time that the Beis HaMikdash was built. So what was the situation in the interim? So the answer is that even though there was the Mishkan in Shiloh, there was the Mishkan in Nov, and in several other places, but nevertheless, we had permission to sacrifice privately.
not every type of a sacrifice, but if a family wanted to express thanksgiving, excuse me, what they call a zebach, festive sacrifice, right? Then the family, friends, and so, you know, could have participated. So that was permitted anywhere. You could build your own boma, your own altar, sacrifice upon it, and, you know, have a sacrificial meal, okay? So we're talking now about the time then. There was a period in time when you had heter bamos, in other words, permission to sacrifice other bamos. But once the Beis HaMikdash was built in Yerushalayim, then the laws that we find in the Torah, particularly in Parsha Re'eh, take effect. Namely, that you can only, any sacrifice has to be brought to the Beis HaMikdash, therefore the bamos went out of the picture. It was considered idolatry to sacrifice on the bamos. This is what the Nevi'im kept preaching against, the fact that people were sacrificing on bamos instead of coming to the Beis HaMikdash. And of course I had a lot of other criticisms as well I need to make, but this is one of the criticisms that they had to make, right? We find that even in the reign of some of the kings who were called good kings, that's right, right, that nevertheless the bombers did not disappear. The people still continued, you know, to sacrifice on them, which was a direct violation of what is said in the Torah, but they continued to do it. So Mishkan prohibited. If you wanted to, it says, if you want to eat, you can only eat by bringing a sacrifice to the Mishkan, and therefore bamos would be prohibited. Once Eretz Yisrael was conquered, but prior to the building of the Beis HaMikdash, bamos are permitted, okay? And then once the Beis HaMikdash comes into existence, at that particular point, bamos are prohibited. Okay. So, this is...
Excuse me.
Yes.
Sacrificing the animal was dedicating it. They could kill an animal just for... They were permitted to slaughter an animal just for food.
In the time that they were in the wilderness, no.
No. That's what I
right. There it says specifically, right, that they are not. First of all, there's a right that if you want to have, then you have to come to the Beis HaMikdash and offer a sacrifice. I don't mean Beis HaMikdash, I mean to the Mishkan, right? And offer a sacrifice. And then you can partake of that, right? But, and then the Pasuk says, V'lo yisbechu od zivcheihem la'asirim, you know, the Pasuk that we quoted on the previous page, on the previous side of the page. Not to sacrifice to Avodah Zarah. Okay. So, what he's saying then, that maybe the pasuk that we have over here is simply to tell us, "Bekodoshim shehikdishim b'shasisa abomos," that these were sacrifices that the man wanted to dedicate at the time when abomos were prohibited, right? The Hikrivon, and what did he do? He sacrifices at this particular point, Bishas Iser HaBomos, right, at the time when Bomos were prohibited, but nevertheless he went ahead and did what? He did that. So in that particular case, Sharei Od Shalomor. So there is a punishment mentioned for having done something like that. Okay? In other words, what is the punishment? So if you read the Torah, go back to it, you'll see, as Rashi quotes over here, he says, Shegidah l'choh inyon is anshon, right? This particular subject matter reveals the fact that the punishment is kores, shehein be kores.
one is Koris. Koris means literally, you know, that the Rebbeinu Shlom cuts you off from life. How, with, what, that's already a different story. How the Rebbeinu Shlom, exacts Koris, you understand, uses the punishment. But nevertheless, there is a punishment mentioned. All right. On Shanomor, he says, Shanomor, but the Pasuk says, we'll Pesach, Ochum, Oved, Lo'ev, Yo, right, if he does not bring the sacrifice to literally the entrance of the Ohel Moed, remember the tent of meeting, which was the Mishkan, right? So the Nichrusah Nefshahi, the Torah continues and says, so that soul is to be subject to the punishment of Koris, of being cut off, okay? So, and the Gemara says, Onish Shemanu. Okay, so the Torah specifically mentions that Koris is going to be the punishment for that. But Ashara Menayan, but where is the Pasuk that tells us that it's wrong to do it? When we studied the Gemara in Makkos, going back God knows how many years now, at that particular point we learned that in general, Ein onshin ela mikein masirin, which means you're not allowed to punish unless you have first warned people that it's wrong to do it. Understand?
Right.
So the question is, so where is this warning saying that it's wrong? That's Horem and I. So he says, Talmud Loma. Well, the Torah says, Pen ta'ale olasebiyah. Right? Lest, literally, right, you offer up your sacrifices. Look at Rav Ovid, and even as interpreted by Rav Ovid, Amarav Elov, says the name Rav Elov, excuse me, the Omar Rav Ovid, who quoted Rav Ovid, right, all right, my eyes keep jumping up and down all the time. Rabbi Eloy says, Kol Mokom Shenema, wherever in the Torah you find the word Ishomer, right? Be careful, particularly, right? Be careful what? Be careful not to do something other, obviously, is what it means, right? Or pen, don't. Lest you do something or other, that you should not do it, right? Or the al, right? Don't do something or other. So, eino ela b'lei sa'aseh, right? These expressions indicate the fact that this is a mitzvah that you're not allowed to do. Okay? Remember that we have affirmative commandments and we have negative commandments. So this is the kind of a language, if it said Ishomer, or if it said Pen, or if it said Al, then it means this is a mitzvah that you're not allowed to do. Mitzvah consists of not doing this particular act. Okay?
It's
a negative, right. As for example, we say in Krishna, right? Ishomer lochem, piyantelavadchem, misatem, vadatem, right? In other words, be careful that your heart doesn't deceive you and go and serve other gods, etc., etc. Okay? So we see, this is it, right? So, Mekanda Eilach, and after that, Umedabe Bekotchim, Shekdishim Mishas Hetah HaMomis, right? He talks about sacrifices that were permitted at the time when Bomis were permitted. He grieved, but what happened? And these things were permitted at one time when Bamis were permitted, but the grieved, he took these sacrifices and he wanted to offer them Bishas Isra Bamis at a time when the Bamis are prohibited. So Shanama, as the Pasuk says, Laman Asher Yovu B'nei Yisrael Ezifchehem Asherhem Zolchim, says the purpose of what the Torah says in Sefer Vayikra over there is that the Jews, instead of killing animals wherever they were in the wilderness, that they are to bring it to the oil moed, right, and offer it as a sacrifice, and then that makes it permissible to be eaten, right? Sheitati l'chol kvor al p'nei hasodeh. I've already given you permission before, and it's to be like al p'nei hasodeh. That verse, it's a little difficult to understand what this particular means. Okay? Excuse me. But how Rashi understands is that Apnei HaTzodeh means worshipping or sacrificing to idols of the Desire. Apnei HaTzodeh, Lord Vedas Kechov, he says. Okay. So, in other words, that Melamed is to teach us the following lesson. Shekol HaZaveach B'Boma B'Shas Yisr HaBomas, right, that anyone who offers up a sacrifice on a Boma at the time when Bomas are prohibited, right, so Ma'ala Alav HaKosov, it's as if he is performing an action which the Torah indicates is Ki'ilu HuZaveach Al P'nei HaZaveach, as if he is sacrificing to idols. Okay? So in other words, if the Torah says at this particular point in time you're not allowed to sacrifice except if you come to the Beis HaMikdash, or if you come to the Mishkan in the wilderness and so on, and you sacrifice on the Bomas at a time when Bomas are prohibited, it's as if you were sacrificing to idolatry. That's the point. Even if your intention was to sacrifice to the Beis HaMikdash, but it's as if you're sacrificing to idolatry.
So all of these sacrifices that we remember, the northern kingdom, Balgam, and all of his successors, when they set up the
the two Bate Mikdash that they had over there, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Don
and Bethel, correct.
All of those were invalid, all those were Easter.
From the point of view of normative Judaism, the answer is yes. But how they looked upon it, that's already a different story.
There's a lot of stuff going on in that northern kingdom.
Right, right. To them, it was their way of worshiping. I mentioned on other occasions, I mean, why do they build those temples in Bethel and in Dan? Because basically, they wanted to prohibit Jews from going to Yerushalayim. Right, it was political action on the part of Yeruvim ben Nevat, who purposely did that, and as you know, our tradition tells us, he stationed armies and guards in order to prevent anybody from wanting to go to Yerushalayim and to sacrifice over there. So that the Gemara in Tainus tells us at the very end of the about the 15th day of Av, there are all kinds of reasons why it's a holiday, okay? Even though the average Jew has never heard of the 15th day of Av, okay? But one of them is the fact that the last king of Israel finally gave permission that people could go to Yerushalayim. He saw that the kingdom was coming to an end at the hands of the Assyrian conquerors. So he gave permission to go to Yerushalayim. So, and it was on the 15th of Av. This is one of the reasons why we celebrate. Okay. All right. Yes.
Right. When the Assyrians conquered that northern, the northern.
Yes.
Northern Israel, right.
Was that the tradition in any way a punishment for the pollution?
Okay. Yeah, needless to say, this is the feeling that the Nevi'im, the prophets, had.
Yeah.
That the punishment was the punishment that was deserved because they had turned to idolatry. Right. Right. Idolatry? Well, the idea is what is expressed over here. That they thought that they were doing something that was right, but in reality, it was wrong. It's as if they were practicing idolatry. Of course, also, there were those who really did practice idolatry, too. Baal, Shtoret, and so on and so forth, you know. Right. I mean, in the time of Eliyahu HaNavi, I mean, he fought bitterly against the people who were doing this. Go up to the Mishnah. All right. Now, the Pasuk says, Vehene Yod Lod Hashem. They are to bring them to Hashem. That is to bring the sacrifices to Hashem. A negative commandment, right? Pen, right? Don't do it, right? And we have also an affirmative. We want you to bring it to Hashem and not to the idols, okay? So, Zu mitzvas aseh. Mitzvas leisah sebenayin, and how do we know that there's also a negative commandment? Talmud Leva, the Pasuk says, V'lo yizbechu od ez nivcheihem. They are no longer to sacrifice their sacrifices. Of course, as we said, Lasi'irim, right, idolatry. So it says, Yochol, yehe onush kores. So, are we to assume then that he would be punished with kores? So Talmud Leimar, so this is why the Pasuk then says, Chukas Olam Tiyeh Zos Lohem. This is to be an eternal statute to you. Zos Lohem Velo Acheres. In other words, doing it the proper way to Hashem, this is an eternal law. But any other way is not eternal. Omar Rava says, Kori Bey says, you can read the Pasuk in the following way. Lo yizbechu, they are not to sacrifice the kori bay, and also the lo od, and no longer either. So in other words, that they are not to sacrifice, right, when no longer, because now the bobos are prohibited. So if you sacrifice on the bobos now, even though your intentions were good, so nevertheless, it's as if you were sacrificing to one way to suffer. As long as my voice will hold out, I don't guarantee tonight. Okay, tonight is the 8th of November in the year 2006. We are continuing now from where we left off last week. Avodah Zorah. Nun Aleph Omen Beis, which means 51b. And we start with a Mishnah that we have on the third long line that you see over there.
I got it. Okay.
This was actually quoted previously, but this is the source, because the Gemara's discussion that we had before naturally they're going to cite different things, and so one of the things that they cited was this Mishnah and also the following Mishnah that we have on this page. Okay, so we start with this one first. It says Motsa Barosh HaBoas Jesus O Caleb HaVielu Mutar. Alright, so far it seems simple. It says that if you find on the head of the idol either money or a garment or some implements, whatever they may be, those things are permitted. In other words, we don't consider them as an integral part of the worship of that particular idol.
So in a way it's almost economic, because they found...
They found coins over
coins
there. Okay, right. So they could simply take them and use them, okay? That's what it says so far. Okay? Then, Parkilei Anovim Torah Shal Shibonim V'yenus V'shimonim Islosos. What if, on the other hand, we find in connection with the idol over there a branch of a grapevine with a cluster of grapes, okay? Or a Torah Shal Shibonim. This means wreaths which are made out of grains. Or wine, let's say a jar of wine over there. Or shmonim, or oil, olive oil, right? Slosos, or fine meal, you know, fine wheat that had been ground very fine. So, right? So, in that particular case, then what? Or any other object which would normally be sacrificed or used in connection with the sacrifices on the altar in the Beis HaMikdash. And if you saw these same things with the idol, then in that particular case, also, then they are prohibited. Okay? So, first of all, the Gemara wants to know, how do we know these things? Meaning, where is there a source in the Torah for this particular ruling? That if you find, you know, money or some object or something or other, you know, how do we know that that's prohibited?
So it says,
the money, we said, is not.
But
the latter part of the, the latter part of the Mishnah, all those things are prohibited, right? Anything that you could see was in connection with either the kind of practice that was carried on in the Beis HaMikdash, or that in those days they knew they associated with the worship service of idols. In other words, the branch of the vine branch with a cluster of grapes on it. Now in the Beis HaMikdash,
wine that was made.
Yeah, the only time that you would have something like that would be maybe, let's say, that you bring first fruits of the Beis HaMikdash.
It
makes sense. And the same thing, you know, for the wreaths that they made out of grains or something like that, was not done. But, for example, the baskets that they brought in, they were decorated when they would bring the basket of first fruits and so on. So these are things then that were practiced in connection with sacrifices, and so therefore that would be prohibited. So as I said, the Gemara starts off by wanting to know where is there a source in the Torah for this. All right. So I'm a Rabbi Chiya by Yosef, I'm a Rabbi Hoshaya. Rabbi Chiya bar Yosef said the name of Rabbi Hoshaya. He said, "Kosav echad b'me." You have one pasuk which says, "Vatiru eshikutzehem, v'yezgilu lehem, Eitz bo evin kesev v'zohav asher imohem. Okay? You saw the abominations and the terrible things of the idolaters in Canaan, right? You've seen that, or in Egypt, right? And you've seen how they have eitz, wood, right? Or evan, stone, kesef, silver, zahav, and gold, asher imohem, which were connected with these idols. So that's one pasuk, okay? The kosev echad omer. Then we have another pasuk which says, "Lo sachmo kesef zahav aleihem." You shall not covet the silver or the gold on it. All right. Excuse me. So I ask you, compare the two psukim and tell me what is missing in the second one as compared to the first one. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the psukim in the Torah that they quote. First one says, what you should say,
wood and stone?
Eitz for heaven. Wood and the stone that we have in the first pasuk is missing in the second one. The second one only speaks about
you want some water?
So we see that only silver and gold are mentioned in the second pasuk that we have. Okay. One pasuk, if you notice, uses the word imohem, with them, and the other one uses the word alehem, right? So the Gemara now says, okay, Horketza says, how are we to understand this? Okay, says, notice that imohem dumyo da alehem, that the pasuk which has the word imohem, you know, eitz for heaven, kesef zahav asher imohem, you know, that are with them, it stresses upon what word? With. As compared to, so he says, it's similar, compared to the aleihem, the second pasuk, which says gold and silver upon them. Ma aleihem. Now, just as the pasuk that says aleihem, in other words, the one that says silver and gold, right? And what are silver and gold? It says dovor shel noi. These are things of beauty, right? So these are osur, these are prohibited. So therefore, we have to conclude that she'eino shel noi, those things which are not things of beauty, namely what? Wood, stone, right? Mutar afi mohem, are permitted even if they are with them. And kol masha imohem, af alehem, whatever is prohibited imohem should also be prohibited alehem. So he says, so im came, so if that's the case, lo yomar aleihem, right? Why does it have to say aleihem if they're the same? So in other words, we have to make a distinction between what the first pasuk, you know, that they quote is compared to the second one. Now, Moos, Dovishal Noihu, right? There are those who say that money is a thing of beauty. So that therefore, what should we say? If there's any money, then what? Should be prohibited, correct? Because it says, what? In the pasuk that says silver and gold. we said that they're things of beauty, right? And we said that those are definitely also, because it says those sachmo, you're not allowed to have a desire for them, okay? So that therefore we should say, well, money too belongs in the same category, right? Isn't something a beauty, right? So Amri Devei Rabbi Yonah, so it said, I'll tell you, it says, if it says Bekis Kosher, this is how they understand it, that if you have a little bag which is tied to the idol, the Toluilo, the Sadoro, around its neck, right? Then in that particular case, we say that that is definitely there for what?
Decoration.
It's a decoration. In other words, it's an offering. You understand?
Right.
So that would make it prohibited. Whereas if you simply find a couple of coins on top, it's not. It's not a thing of beauty. And they say, how about ksus, garment, dovishol noihuk? That could also be a thing of beauty, right? So I'm the Rabbi Yonah again, school of Rabbi Yonah, they say, somebody simply had a garment which was folded up and lying there on the head of the idol. In other words, it was only left there. You had no place else to put it down, so you put it down over there for the time being. Okay? Kli. Something, you know, a keli, an implement, a goblet or something, I mean, dovishol noihu, that could also be something of beauty. So Rav Papa said, this kifo le mashkilta areshe, which Rashi interprets as follows. It says, that it's lying on top of the stone like a cover, but he says this word that we have over there, shkilta and so on, meshiklo something. So the word implies like a basin that you use in order to wash something, to wash clothing with, okay? So in other words, the guy simply put a basin on top. Now, a basin is not a thing of beauty, you understand? He got tired of something, so we put it on top. So you have to take a look and see, is it a thing of beauty or is it not a thing of beauty? If it's a thing of beauty, and in that case, obviously it's there in order to honor the idol. But if it's not a thing of beauty, they're simply using it as a convenient resting place for whatever it may be, then in that particular place, it doesn't have any particular sanctity of its own. Omar Ravasi Bar Chia, so Ravasi Bar Chia said, Kol shehu lifnim min ha'klu kalin, afilu mayim melech osur. So first of all, we have to know what is this word kilkalin. So Rashi explains that kilkalin, he says, this is a hanging that you have, and what they did is in order to protect the idol, so they would put hangings around it, you know, to make like a little private sanctuary, so to speak. So this is what he says. He says, if it's within the area which is surrounded by these hangings, in other words, it's close to the idol, then in that particular case, we have to assume that whatever the object is there in order to do what? Obviously, to pay homage to the idol. Okay? So this is what he says, that I feel a mayim melach, even if you only saw water or salt over there, obviously the water or the salt is there as in order to pay tribute to the idol, as long as it's within the curtained area, so to speak. Okay. Well, yeah, he's trying to define, you know, when can you say that, you know, that you don't pay any attention to it, and when do you say that you do have to consider as dedicated to Aveda Zara. So before, we made a general principle, right? General principle is Dover Shaldoi. In other words, if it is a thing of beauty connected with an idol, then we know that it's there in order to show, you know, to pay homage to the idol, right? Well, normally salt and water are not exactly things of, you know, showing honor, except, I mean, of course, the person invites you to his home or something like that. Naturally, he's going to offer you water and salt, right? So, that being the case, if it's within the curtained area around the idol, then it means that this is an offering which is being given to the idol itself. I mean, we know that they used to bring baskets of fruit, of food, whatever it may be, you know. This is done throughout the ancient world in connection with idols. So, therefore, if it's within the curtains, then in that case it's prohibited, even if it's only water or salt. But if it's outside, then in that particular case, if it is Dover Shaldoi, something which is a thing of beauty, then in that case it's Osir, right? It's prohibited. But She'enu Shaldoi, but if it's not a thing of beauty, then in that particular case, then it's Mutar, it's permissible. Omar Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina said, Naktinan, we gather from this, he says, that, or we have a tradition, this is really what he's trying to say, we have a tradition, he says, that Ein Kilkelin Lo Lipa'or Lo Lamarkulis. Okay, that they do not put curtains either around the ore or mercury. Or, if you remember, this was the idol of Moab, and this, right, and we've already said several times that the way people would worship it, according to the tradition, is that they would defecate in front of it. Don't ask me why. Maybe they felt that this was a good cure for constipation if they did that. I don't know. But, yeah. The root itself, you know, of course it's a name over here, but nevertheless the root itself means to open up, to bear something or something like that. So it's easy enough, I mean, to see why they connected it with this particular way, right? So, and so the tradition, he says, we have a tradition that neither Peor nor Mercury, the statue of Mercury, had any curtains around it. So the Gemara says, Lamai. So why are you telling me this? Ilema, if you say it is Dafilu Penim Kehutz Dome, that whether it's inside or outside, it makes no difference because they're the same. The Shorei, and therefore it should be permitted, in other words, that you should be able to permit, even if it's within the curtains, as long as it's not a thing of beauty. So he says, Hashta, Lord, now, we're in the foreign coming, you know that, how they worship the Peor, having excrement in front of it. And Mayim and Melach, they did not offer water and salt to it. Elo afilu chutz kifadim domi v'yoser. But rather, we have to say that even whatever is outside is like what's inside the curtains and is prohibited. In other words, what the latter statement is saying, that it should make no difference whether it's within the curtains or outside the curtains. In any case, you have to say that it's prohibited. You know, this is his point of view, all right? And this is a halacha, incidentally. As we can see from the reference to the Mishnah Torah, by one of these that we have in the upper corner of it.
Whether it's inside or outside, still the first distinction applies that of its beauty.
The Dove Shel Noi, right.
Okay.
Right. Or if it's something which is normally a form of worship. So these are two prohibited categories, okay?
Like the salt and the water, is that a normal, they consider that a normal
point of view? Well, that's a difference of opinion. The first one said nothing, and then the second one says, the first one says that if it's within the curtains, then you know it's an offering.
Right.
Outside doesn't mean anything.
Right.
But this last statement says it makes no difference whether it's inside or outside. Whatever they have salt and water over there for. So he says it's prohibited. So, yeah. So it's the difference of authorities, you know, as to how they look upon these things.
Well, if offering salt and water are a matter of respect to guests, maybe it's a form of respect to the idol.
Yes. Yes, it is, no question about it. But there's more than that, too. Actually, both salt and water do play a certain role even in the worship service of the Beis HaMikdash. We have a rule that says that kol korbancha tavi melech, that whatever korban is brought, it has to be salted. To be salted.
No,
okay.
That's why kosher is
it. It reminds you of kosher, exactly. Right.
And they want to get rid of the blood.
Yeah.
So they
but
the blood
it
out.
Even applied to a meal offering, that they had to add a pinch of salt to it. Okay. Because that too is considered a korban, you understand? So sacrifice. So that therefore that. So, alright, so salt obviously plays a role. The Beis HaMikdash, they had a chamber which had, a storehouse of salt that they needed in order to salt the various sacrifices. As far as water is concerned, in the Beis HaMikdash, there was only one time when we had what we call Nisach HaMayim, in other words, a libation of water. And of course, that was for Sukkos. And every day of Sukkos, they would, in addition to the wine libation, which was done at all times whenever they sacrificed, but there was also a water libation as well during the Sukkot holiday. So, of course, that's tied in with the idea that we pray for rain so that, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam should give us rainfall during the year and so that things could grow and prosper. Yes?
Although you mentioned salt on challah, there's another way. When you go into a new apartment or a new home, you bring water, salt and bread.
That's an old European custom.
But there was something was done very clearly.
I
remember doing it and having it done for me.
Correct. Whenever you went into a new apartment.
People would bring
resident.
Right. Somebody would bring you the salt.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Salt and bread.
Salt and bread.
Right, right.
Yeah.
All right, we'll go on just for a little bit longer and start the next special. Pardon me? Right. Right, right.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. So,
But I would love sometimes to find out why salt was included. I know bread, I can understand bread, but salt.
Salt was always considered a very important element.
I know that.
Right.
I
mean, we know that.
It was used as a preservative, for example.
Correct.
That I know.
Correct.
But I don't understand it in relation to bread and salt being, or salt in the challah or whatever.
Well.
The ancients weighed out salt like
Roman soldiers were paid, part of their pay was with salt. Yeah. And this is how we have the word salary derived from the Latin word for salt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
But the salt is the basic, flavor.
Right. Yeah. Right.
You know, it,
enhancer, preservative. We know that you have to have subsodium inside of you. It shouldn't have too much, but you have to need these subsodium.
And I don't have to worry. Everything's got more than we need.
Sodium and potassium, electrolytes. All right, let's do the next Mishnah. Avodas kechovim, shehoya lo gino or merchots den imehem shaloi b'teiva, v'yeinen imehem b'teiva. Which means as follows. There is an idol temple, okay? And attached to it is a gino, in other words, a little garden, right? Or merchots, or maybe a bathhouse. So in that particular case, the question is, can a Jew use those facilities? Understand? Can a Jew go into the garden and have a nice ratzir or something like that, sit down and enjoy the fresh air and so on? And, or can he go, for example, into the bathhouse and bathe over there?
Why is there a question? Where is it?
Because the question is right now as follows. Here we go. It says, if it's shalom, then in mehen shalom betova, right? Which means you are permitted to enjoy these facilities as long as you don't pay for them. Okay, come back to that in a moment. V'yeinen in mehen b'tova, but you're not allowed to use the facilities if you have to pay for them. So the question is, what is this business of payment? Are we considering it as a commercial enterprise? Or are we considering it instead as benefiting the idol itself?
I'm making a donation.
Right, exactly. So, if we consider it as a donation to the idol, then in that case, what do we have to say? It would be prohibited. But if you don't have to pay anything for it, then in that case, because the idol is not gaining anything by your, using these facilities.
I'm just thinking of the Baha'i Temple. Actually, if you went to a trip to India,
right,
had some kind of a, or the Far East, people go to Thailand.
We must have
entrance fees to see these facilities.
Correct.
And keep them up.
Yeah, they do.
Not the Baha'i Temple. There's no entrance fee. We went there.
I understand the Baha'i Temple. You can go in certain parts, but you're not allowed to go into the sanctuary itself.
Right.
Yeah, from the garden, we went into a building, we had to take our shoes off.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was,
All right, now the Mishnah continues and says, Hoyer Shelo, Shelacherim, let's say, however, that this garden or this bathhouse belonged to both the idol temple and to others. In other words, there was a partnership. It wasn't 100% exclusively for the house of idolatry. Okay? So, in that particular case, the Mishnah says, then in mehen bein betovo, bein shalom betovo. Right? You are permitted to use the facilities, enjoy the facilities. After all, the word nehenin implies, that you're making use, but you're also having enjoyment, because this is why we have the word hanoah, which I'm sure you're familiar with even from Yiddish, okay? We're permitted to have use of them, whether you pay for it or you don't pay for it, because the money is now to be considered as going to what? A joint enterprise, but we don't know which part of the money is going to go to the idol temple. It could go to the other partners over there that are involved. Now, the last part of the Mishnah says, Avedis kirchovim shalevit kirchovim asura biyad. An idol that belongs to an idolater is prohibited immediately to a Jew. Minute that the idol is made for the goy, a Jew is prohibited from having any hanor from it, right? But Meshal Yisrael, what if it's an idol that a Jew has? Say he goes into the manufacturing business, making an idol, right? Or he decides to do it, I don't know, to decorate his house. He wants a Buddha in order to decorate his house.
Right.
Or in order to sell it, obviously, sure. So in that particular case, Ein Asura Archate Oved. The idol does not become prohibited until actually it's going to be worshipped. Once that happens, then you know that that's serious business is an idol, and then it's prohibited to the Jew. I'm going to stop at this point because I don't know how long. Tonight being the 22nd of November in the year 2006, so we continue on Aved Azora, Nun Aleph of the days, 51b, with the Gemara on the last mission. So, Omar Abaye. So, now Abaye wants to explain this business about what do we mean by Betova, Shalom Betova, and so he says. Betova, what does the Mishnah mean when it says that, you know, it's for a benefit, or it's for somebody's good? Who's good? So he says, Betova's Komor, Komorin. A Komor is one of the Hebrew words that they use for a priest or a minister of another religion. Okay? Here, of course, it means a priest of Avodah Zarah. Okay? So, in that particular case, the Tova means that if you pay, then obviously you are benefiting the priests, right? And, of course, benefiting the whole idolatrous enterprise over there that they represent. Shalom B'tova, what does that mean? So it says, Shalom B'tova's Kamor, right? It means then that you're not giving any benefit, any payment or any benefit, you know, to the priests. So, the question is right now, right, why do they stress the fact the priests in this Baraisa? You understand? Why do they stress it? So the answer is because what we find in the next phrase. The next phrase says, La Fuke, now this excludes Tovas of Deho de Shore. It says this excludes benefiting idol worshippers, but not who? Not the clergy, in other words. An ordinary goy who has an idol of if you want to give him some benefit, you can give him some benefit, you see. So, then in that case, the shori is permitted. Now, there are those who go to the latter part of the statement, and they try to explain it as follows. It says, that was the latter part, remember? First it said not the benefit, but then the Mishnah says that if it benefits both the house of idolatry and others that are in partnership. So it says, then in Mehem B'teva, V'shalei B'teva, right? The Mishnah says that you're allowed to have enjoyment, have use of the facilities, whether you pay or whether you don't pay. So Abaye explains his point of view that what does B'tova mean? So again, betovas acherim shelo betova shelo betovas kohav. In other words, what is the meaning of betova? He says betova means that you are benefiting who? Acherim. In other words, others, not the clergy. Shelo betova, right? Shelo betovas kohav. But where it says that, you know, that you're not allowed to make use of these facilities if you have to pay for whom? So it says for the benefit of the priests. So he says, "Mam the masli say for kochiket aresha." Those who are laying stress upon the latter statement, namely that if you're benefiting just an ordinary person but not a priest, then then in that case there's no question about the fact that, you know, where it says that you're allowed to go into the garden or the bathhouse, obviously we make that distinction, right? But those who lay stress upon the first part of the statement, it says of all asefo, but if you interpret, you lay the stress only upon the first part, then they say, Kevin the Ika Acherim Bahado, Zafilabatevis Kovim Nami Shapitabe. This is a very unusual idea. They say that if the first part we said that if you have the facilities, right, then in that particular case, if you pay, then you can't use it. If you don't pay, then you can use it, right? And we says, paying who? So it said, you know, paying the priests, right? And right. But the latter part of the statement, which says that that, you know, if there's partnership, then what would we normally say? Normally would say that what the Mishnah says is that in partnership we are permitted to use the facilities. It says, you know, whether you are, whether indirectly, shall we say, some of it may go to the priests, but nevertheless, because there are others who are involved, so you're not doing it. Yes.
It seems the rationale is that you don't subsidize.
You don't want to, exactly. That's exactly what it is. You don't want to subsidize.
Even if you're indirectly subsidizing, right, you're still subsidizing.
Well, in a sense, some of it could be, you could say that it was used for what, upkeep, maintenance, guard, whatever.
Yeah, right, right. But the point is, we don't really know which portion of the money is going there. So therefore we say, look, we don't know. We have to assume that the partners are getting the major benefit of it. Our money is going to the partners. This is what we have in mind. Our money is going to the partners. Our money is not going to the priests. It's a supposition.
I kind of agree with you.
Going to the YMCA.
Right.
Well, I kind of agree for you. If they don't have to pay, for example, even if all the money was going, let's say, to the maintenance of the garden,
right,
that would mean that that organization's funds, whatever other funds they had, could be used.
Yeah, indirectly, of course, there's no question.
It's fungible money.
Right. It's just an accounting thing.
You know, it's a similar argument.
We're freeing up their money
so they can,
exactly,
use it for religious purposes.
Exactly.
It's just an accounting
thing. Theoretically, we give money to the Palestinian Authority in order to prevent hardship to the citizens, right? Mm-hmm. But obviously, if we're subsidizing that, then it means that the government itself, they don't have to pay for them, that they can use the money for munitions and stuff like that, which is exactly what they're doing, you know.
You know, by the way, right, the same concept is a sticking point as far as financial aid, college, you know, kids get money like the Morrison, and they get money. But the college takes money away from them.
Right.
So they're
going to
grant
that money.
It frees up money to give to somebody else, and let's say Ashkosh, Wisconsin. So, Gordy Morrison, father James Morrison,
right,
they subsidized NatWestern Mass. Who knows?
Still a Norris and scholarship, I suppose. What is it? It's probably administered by the National Council, because they were the ones who were always administering all these scholarships that the Jews paid for.
James, he was administered by one of the banks.
I'm
not sure where it is now.
Yeah. What is your site this week? It's
a very big pond.
His money's used for something else, I think, too. But the father, that's one of the things. He went to the banks when he established his trust.
Right.
It's worth well into the millions now. They get about $600,000 every year.
It is. It's worth probably close to 10.
Okay. Now, the Mishnah then continued and talks about an idol of a Jew, an idol of a Goy, right? And what did the Mishnah say? The Mishnah said that the idol of a Goy is immediately prohibited. In other words, the minute that the Goy makes the idol, then in that particular case, it's automatically prohibited for a Jew to have any benefit thereof. On the other hand, we said if a Jew makes an idol, then what? That until that idol is going to be worshipped, he could do whatever he wants with it, okay? But if the idol is going to be worshipped, at that point it becomes prohibited to the Jew. This is what the Mishnah says. Now, obviously, that, you can imagine, is not according to everybody's opinion. So that this is what they
learned out. The idol of a Jewish idolatry. Is that an oxymoron? Is there such a thing as a Jewish idolatry?
Well, I guess theoretically, just as like you have, you know, Jews for Yoshka or something like that. Jews for Yoshka. From our point of view,
like the born again Jews.
Right.
But are they Jews? Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. No, I understand your question.
Right.
I understand your question. If he's an idolater, to me, it seemed like prima facie.
You're right.
He no longer would be Jewish.
Yeah. If he actually worships the idol, you can be sure that in that particular case, there's no question he's an idolater. He's no longer a Jew, even if he was a Jew by birth. Of course, that brings in, you know, the sticky problem. The fact that according to Jewish law, a Jew who is a sinner still remains a Jew. You understand? So even though he has sinned by becoming an idolater, technically he still is Jewish. Whether you can count him to a minion is already a different story.
You know, you're aware of this case, the brother Daniel case in Israel about the law of return.
Right.
They decided that if someone was a Jew who adopted Christianity, became actually a monk, professed Christianity, so in that case they said since he no longer had any belief, any